You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
And so then it really heated up. I thought every day we're going to go to war.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Colonel William Gregory served in the U.S. Army Air Corps and saw extensive combat over North Africa and Europe during World War II, rising to the position of squadron commander. It was his squadron that flew many of the spy missions over Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was later awarded a medal by the CIA for his service, as well as a letter of appreciation by President Kennedy. Now, some of our fans are helping the podcast financially, so if you'd like to join this select band, then you can sign up to Patreon for the price of a couple of coffees a month. You really help us cover the show's increasing costs and keep us on the air, plus you get that sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster too. Just go to patreon.com/coldwarpod. That's patreon.com/coldwarpod. Today's episode is brought in conjunction with the Cold War Museum, and I'm delighted to welcome Colonel William Gregory to Cold War Conversations.
Well, by that time, I was flying bombers, and Korea was not a good... I think we had very, very limited bombers used in Korea. In fact, I was flying the B-29 at that time, so we had several wings of B-29s at that time, and they were one or two wings over there, but I did not engage in flying in Korea. But then the B-29 was replaced by the B-47. It was a six-engine airplane, a really beautiful airplane. It was streamlined, and I really liked that airplane a lot. And I was flying it. I was offered an assignment. It was a classified assignment in high-altitude airplanes, which I didn't know anything about. But anyhow, it was... it was called Project Black Knight,
right?
And we had the B-57, and we had the D model B-57. It was a limited production airplane, only 20 of them, and it would fly to 60,000 feet. And I was in that program for 4 years. And then after that, I got a squadron of U-2s that would fly about 72,000 feet, as you know.
Wow, that's some height.
yes, it was. So then I had a squadron of U-2s. When Gary Powers was shot down on May the 1st, 1960, I was waiting for orders to go to Atsugi in Japan. I was going to be the operations officer over there. I was lieutenant colonel at the time. When he was shot down, it changed everything. The U.S. they had a squadron at Atsugi and then one in Turkey. President Eisenhower decided to bring all the planes back and people back to the States. And he had said there would be no more overflights. And so then, instead of going to Japan, I went to Edwards Air Force Base, and we had a squadron there. Well, we were actually at North Base, which was about 10 miles from the main base. It was an old World War II base, a satellite base, and we had to clean it up a bit, but it was good for us to be removed from the main base there at Edwards. when all the people were brought back, the colonels that had been doing this mission before, they were released. And as a lieutenant colonel, I was the ranking officer. And so then I became the acting commander there at Edwards. And I wasn't sure what their program was going to be, if any. I thought maybe we were going to have to deactivate the squadron because of what the president had said. But anyhow, within 6 months, headquarters in Washington had directed that we was start overflying Cuba. So that was in, I guess, 61. And then 62, we were found a lot. This is when we the Cuban Missile Crisis evolved. And we had initially found surface-to-air missiles there in Cuba. And we also knew they had some planes there, Soviet planes there. And so, and eventually they had the long-range missiles in Cuba, which we found as well. So President Kennedy's staff at that time was sort of equally divided. About half of them wanted to knock out the missiles immediately, which we could have done, but it might have started a war. And the other half wanted to try to use diplomacy. So that actually worked out well. But there was for a week there, I thought every day we were going to go to war, but it didn't happen. And we had pictures of the missiles in Cuba. Yeah. And so the Soviets eventually decided to remove the missiles and the airplanes and all the equipment they had there in Cuba. And so it was settled in that way, which yeah. was a good thing.
Yeah. Can I ask you a few questions yeah. on Cuba? With you being the commanding officer, you weren't flying the missions, were you?
No, I was not.
So the pilots that you were, you know, sending on these missions, I mean, what they were flying at high altitude over Cuba, but some of them, at least one or two U-2s were shot down, weren't they, over Cuba?
One. Right. Yeah, one was shot down. Mm-hmm.
And was that one of your pilots?
No, actually, I had CIA pilots, and these were Air Force. That pilot was an Air Force pilot. I knew him well. He had trained in our airplane at my base at Edwards, and had him there for a few days. Also, after we had found the missiles in Cuba, there was a big discussion if we would continue, if my guys would continue to do the overflights, or if the Air Force would. And it was finally decided that the Air Force would continue to do the overflights of Cuba at that point, because they thought it would be better if things got bad, that would be better for the Air Force to be involved rather than the CIA. And so from that point, the Air Force took over, and it was one of their people that were shot down.
Yeah.
But anyhow, we did have those pictures that showed the missiles in Cuba. It was settled that way.
Yeah. And were you aware at the time of the importance of the work that you were carrying out?
In fact, I had wondered if we were going to have a mission at all, because after Gary Powers was shot down, it looked like we probably didn't have a mission with the U-2. But anyhow, after that, I guess it was 6 months later, after we arrived there at Edwards, we got this directive to begin overflying Cuba. And it was good to have a mission, because an organization doesn't function very well if it has nothing to do. But also, we were training. I had all of our guys flying a lot, and we were training, even though we didn't know for what. But we didn't see anything for a time there in Cuba in 1960, late 1960. But by 62, and we would do this periodically. We would fly a number of missions, and then they'd say, that's enough. You can stand down for a while, and then we would do it again. But by January of 62, we found a lot of Soviet people in Cuba in this one area. It was at that time that we found these Soviet airplanes. And so then it really heated up.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
We didn't know the importance of this at the time, but we had found, my group had found these surface-to-air missiles. There was one of the long-range missiles, and I think eventually they had a total of three there of the long-range missiles, and they were desperately trying very hard to get these old combat ready, or get the missiles fired up and are ready to launch. And we avoided a war by not trying to knock out the missiles beforehand.
Yeah. And how were the crews or the pilots briefed before a mission? Were your pilots expecting surface-to-air missiles to be fired at them?
Yes, they thought that this could be a possibility, yes. We hadn't found any surface-to-air missiles there early on, but by late in 62, it was about mid-year in 62, we began flying. I think it was August of 62 that we discovered the first surface-to-air missiles. And so we knew at that time that we were vulnerable for them. If one of my guys got shot down, we just had to admit it. That later, they had this crazy story. I think when Powers was flying, story was that they were flying along the Soviet border, and due to compass error, they strayed into Soviet territory. It'd been far better if they'd told the truth, because I think Powers was about 1,500 miles inside the Soviet Union when he was shot down. So the story was not true.
Yeah, that's one hell of a navigation error.
Yes, yes, yes.
If one of your pilots was shot down, what were they instructed to do if they were shot down over Cuba?
We did survival practice, and we told them that they would able to parachute out if they were shot down, but that never happened. We didn't have a phony story, that just the truth, that we would try to get them out.
Right. So if they were shot down, what would they identify themselves as? Would they say they were a Air Force, or presumably they wouldn't say they were CIA?
I guess we did not. They would just say they were Air Force pilots.
Right.
Or they were pilots.
Yeah.
Not distinguishing.
And with the U-2, I mean, you can't evade a missile in a U-2, can you?
What we did, we had they developed a listening device on the airplane, and if the SA-2 was launched, and this was probably later on, the pilot would begin to make a turn immediately, and hopefully it was thought he would avoid the missile. But we didn't have that at the time our guy was shot down. But that's what we instituted after he was shot down, this was a warning that it was installed on the airplane, and that if this thing, if he got this signal, he was to make this turn. At least they had this warning. It was actually never used, but it was a good thing to have this defensive tactic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the U-2 itself as an aircraft, what was it like to fly?
Well, it was like a kite. Actually, it was a light airplane that could go to 72,000 feet. And actually, when it was built, they had the specification for an airplane that would go this high. What happened, President Eisenhower, he had a report from a RAND study that said a Soviet threat was if they had tried a sneak attack on our bomber forces, that we could lose 75% of our bomber forces. So the U.S. then became very concerned about that happening, or that such an attack might occur. And actually, the Air Force lost 4 airplanes, and the Navy lost 3 airplanes, total of 7. Trying to penetrate the Soviet Union, and of course they were all shot down. And so then the requirement was put out for a company, aircraft manufacturer, to build an airplane that would fly at 70,000 feet, have a payload of at least 650 pounds. And it would have a range of 1,500 miles. And there were 3 companies that were selected and were given development money to do that. Well, Lockheed was not one of them. But Kelly Johnson said that he sold his company on trying for this. And he actually won. So Kelly Johnson built the U-2, which did, from early on, he was the, even though he wasn't selected, he was a winner. And he finally built the U-2. He went through several iterations of how to get that high with a light airplane. And some of the things they came up with were, I think plan was to develop an airplane that would fly off of a sled or something kind, and it wouldn't have landing gear. But that was changed, and that never happened. But so he was really quite successful in developing the U-2, and it could reach that altitude, and it was the winner.
Yeah, and incredibly, I believe there's still versions of the U2 flying today.
That's true. It's a different airplane, but as you suggested, that is true. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
And for years they've been talk of the drones would take over, but they still have not yet in all this time. So they're still flying.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's an incredible longevity for one aircraft. Or type of aircraft, anyway. I understand that you work closely with Kelly Johnson.
I got to know Kelly Johnson pretty well. We did a modification of the U-2 to fly it off of a carrier. And he had to redesign the U-2. I had four pilots. Well, as a matter of fact, if four of us went through it. Well, I also went through it myself through the carrier qualification program, and I selected four of my pilots, and I asked for a spot for myself, and the five of us flew out of Pensacola on the Lexington. But before that, we did a lot of simulated flights. I had a Navy commander assigned to my organization, and he was very good. And pilots did over 100 simulated landings, and I did that as well. And before we went to Pensacola, and then the five of us did the Care Qual program there at Pensacola, and that went well. One of the Navy people, we had to turn the ship around at one time, and we were sort of just waiting. And one of the people said, "Why in the world are you doing this now?" I was a colonel at the time. And he said, "We normally have young guys doing this." And I said, "Well, it was my first opportunity to do this." But anyhow, it was really enjoyable. I have a lot of respect for Navy pilots.
Yeah, I mean the U-2 has, I think, quite a large wingspan, so that must have been That must have made it very difficult landing it on a carrier deck.
Well, it went well because it was no, we had no trouble getting it off. You could about halfway down, well, beyond the island, long before the end of the carrier,
right.
With no assist. We didn't require the JATO assisted takeoff, so the U-2 and of course the carrier was into the wind, and so he was off immediately. We didn't do this a lot, but these pilots never had any problem with this, and we did one exercise. The carrier was the Ranger.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
was at San Francisco Bay, I guess it was, and we loaded onto the Ranger. We were going to go to the South Sea Islands on a cruise, and when we got a beam about, I guess, Hawaii, we flew the two U-2s onto the carrier. Hawaii didn't have anything to do with it. We were not close to Hawaii, but it was about the time we were passing Hawaii. Two of my pilots then flew on to the carrier at that time. And then the mission was to see what the French were doing they had the French Guiana, I guess, a French island down there that we were supposed to do a couple of missions over, which we did.
Right. So, I mean, that's quite interesting because you're effectively spying on your allies there, surely?
Yeah, it really was, yes.
Right. And this was because the French weren't providing a lot of information about their nuclear tests. So with that mission, you were taking photographs, or were you taking atmospheric samples?
Taking photographs. Yeah.
Right. Okay. No, that's really interesting. So how did you end your U.S. Air Force service?
I was offered to go into the SR-71 program, and as the operations officer, I had been gone from home for the, I guess this was about 9 years, more than half the time. And my wife didn't know anything about the SR-71, but she was such a loyal person that I had just come back from another TDY just a few days before I got this offer. And she said, "I just don't know how much longer I can tolerate all these separations." Said my two girls were also, they were in high school. And so I had been gone so much. And so when I was offered this job by the general from Washington, I said, "I've got to think about this." And I told him, I said, "You know, I've been away from home for so much." And so I told him my situation. And he said, "Well, I would understand it. But he said, if you turn it down, you can have the assignment you might want." And so I did. I turned it down, and I asked him to go to the National War College. And that was a good year I had at the National War College. I was going to have a secret or a classified job in the Pentagon. But the general that had asked for me, he got transferred. And I never knew what that job was, but at least I stayed there at the Pentagon for 5 years. I was in research and development there, and we were working on the drone, which was brand new at that time. And any time you're designing a new weapon system, which in this case was a drone, you have a lot of problems with it. And so we had a lot of problems with it then, but of course they are flying all over everywhere now. After that, I had a call from the Air Force Institute of Technology, General Pinson, and he said, "I've been trying to find an assistant here," and he said he would going to be retiring in another year, but he said he would like to have me come out and discuss it. And I told him, I said, it's different from anything I've ever done, and I'm really not that interested. And so he kept talking to me and said, "Would you please come out and let's talk it over." And so anyhow, Then I was not only his deputy, but I was also chief of staff, and I handled all of the staff meetings, and it was a great job, and I was there at the Air Force Institute of Technology for 4 years, and I retired from there. But anyhow, I really made out very well, particularly with the Cuban Missile Crisis. But I was a lieutenant colonel at the time, and I was rewarded. I was promoted to colonel 3 years before I was eligible. I got a letter from President Kennedy about our role in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And also, I got another Legion of Merit. And I actually have four Legion of Merit, which I think there are only three of us in the Air Force that have four or more.
Right. Wow. Wow. That's some honor there. And also the letter from President Kennedy. I'm sure you treasure that.
I do. I do. And then I got the CIA Medal of Merit from the CIA also.
When you were flying, what was the most dangerous situation you ended up in?
I was flying the B-47, and we were in. My crew and I were in North Africa with the B-47. And that was good because we had a mission in the Soviet Union for a target. So we went there for 3 months. And that put us much closer to our target in the Soviet Union. So we were briefed to return home. It was the end of this particular mission. I didn't think we were going to go that day because the weather was really bad. And we were at the very top, I think. We were flying over about 33,000 feet, and we were just over the top of the weather. And we had to get refueling around about Newfoundland. And there was a little level there around 12,000 feet that the tankers could get into. And so I thought we would not do that, but we did. But anyhow, just as I was entering the overcast, all my instruments went out. And so I had to get down through this big overcast with just needle and ball and airspeed. And this was really a tricky operation.
Yeah.
And when I broke out, I would do it the same way if I'd had the instruments, but we made a big circle. It was a deep dive in a circular pattern. And then when I rolled out at 12,000 feet, the tanker was right ahead of me.
Wow.
So that was a good feeling. That was one of the dangers. That was really a dangerous thing. If I lost control, we would, and we had to, and we had crashed. The water was freezing,
yeah.
And so,
yeah.
But that didn't happen.
Well, Greg, I really appreciate your time with me tonight, sharing.
Well, I enjoyed sharing this with you.
Well, no, I've appreciated hearing, you know, your experiences directly from you, because you can read about some of these experiences, you know, written down, but actually
yes.
Speaking to the person themselves brings it much, much more to life. And that's an incredible career you've taken me through there. And I would like to thank you for your service and helping me record your story.
Well, thank you very much. And I appreciate what you're doing.
It was such an honor to speak to Greg and hear a first-hand account from someone so deeply involved in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Thanks again to Gary Powers Jr. and the Cold War Museum for arranging the conversation. If you'd like to learn more, then head over to our show notes, which are at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 80. This will also show as a link in some podcast apps. The show notes also have some videos relating to this episode. You can help us by leaving reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, our Facebook page, or with your favorite podcast provider. This helps to raise our profile and get new guests on the show. If you can't wait for the next episode, go to our Facebook discussion group where our guests and listeners like yourselves continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.